Hey, yo, what is a cipher?
You don't have to be perfect in hip hop. You know, we want raw.
The knowledge of the cipher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cipher come from?
The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cipher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cipher, a weekly podcast bringing you talks with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotero. This is episode 175, a talk with Jerome J-Rock Harmon. Harmon is a Grammy-winning musician and producer, best known for his work with Timbaland. Harmon got his start in Texas, playing gospel and jazz with people like Fred Hammond, Kirk Franklin, and Wayman Tisdale, while producing the occasional hip-hop record on the side. But once he met Timbaland about 10 years ago, his career took off. Harmon has produced, co-produced, or performed on projects by Timbaland, Nas, Chris Brown, Robin Thicke, Jennifer Hudson, Justin Timberlake, Beyonce, Jay-Z, Michael Jackson, and many more. He has won Grammys for his work with gospel icon Fred Hammond, Chris Brown, Justin Timberlake, and Beyonce, and was a key player in albums like Timberlake's The 2020 Experience, Jay-Z's The Blueprint 3 and Magna Carta Holy Grail, and Beyoncé's self-titled LP. We talked to the always working Jerome Harmon at a recording studio in Midtown Manhattan. To make sure you hear each episode of The Cipher as soon as it drops, subscribe on iTunes. Once you do that, you'll also be able to check out our back catalog. If you enjoy this show, for example, you should check out our interview with another producer who knows a thing or two about hit songs, Denon Porter, on episode 119. Also consider helping the show by becoming a patron. Visit us at patreon.com/thecipher show and sign up. Bringing you a show each week takes a lot of time and effort from me and Josh, and we really need your support to continue to maintain this level of output. If even a quarter of our listeners contributed just $1 a month, it would go a long way towards making the show sustainable. As an added bonus for our patrons, we try monthly to share some bonus material that sometimes comes out when talking to our guests after the main interview is over. For December, we have some very special and very early unreleased Ice Cube coming your way. Become a patron by November 30th to get access to the file. If you're curious about any of the songs we're playing during this episode, visit thecyphershow.com to find a complete list. While you're there, sign up for our monthly newsletter to stay on top of what we're up to, on the air and in the wider world. And now, here's a man who knows all about being drunk in love, Jerome Harmon. So the band at Crane High is a pretty big deal, right?
Yeah, it was. 4-3-8 town.
Yeah. So tell me a little about the band and give people a picture of how important it was to the high school.
Well, I had one of the top band directors in the state of Texas, actually in the nation, Scott Mason. And he's currently at Capel High School in Capel, Texas. But he was a graduate from Texas Tech University. And if I tell you, I've never been under a leader who was such a stippler. I mean, he was like intense, super intense. And he embedded that in us as kids, you know, in high school. To him, there was nothing else more important than the band in the entire high school. He could care less about, you know, shop, one act, or, yeah, you know, football, basketball. He didn't care about none of that. To him, that was a number one. Mm-hmm. And he instilled that into us. Even me, as an athlete, I was an athlete. Like, you know, and, you know, I thought basketball was more important. But being under him, he made me realize how, you know, more important it was to me to be able to focus on music, because he knew that that would elevate me in any other thing that I've done. So, I mean, we took it to heart. Like, it was very, very, very competitive. I mean,
And this was a marching band, concert band, both?
All of it.
Yeah.
One marching band, solo and ensemble, concert, it was all the same to him. Mm-hmm. I mean, right now today, he's dealing with some illness because he never slept. He was day and night with it. If he had to go in and think of an arrangement, he would sit there right in front of us and write out arrangements for us and present it to us, and we have to play it right there on the spot. Like, this is how brilliant he was.
Wow.
And that competitiveness that he had inspired me to be more competitive because I saw it in him, and it kind of just sparked something. So I think in my life of music, he was the most important factor from my freshman year on.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so you said you were into sports,
mm-hmm.
and that, you know, we were talking off air, you turned down a chance to go to Berklee because they didn't have a basketball team.
Yeah.
Berklee College of Music in Boston, Massachusetts is the largest independent college of contemporary music in the world. Known for the study of jazz and modern American music, it boasts famous alumni like Quincy Jones, Branford Marsalis, and Sean Sotero. It does not have an athletics program. Jerome would have had to go there for his piano playing alone.
What sports did you play?
I played it all. Football, basketball, and track, because we, you know, Crane, let me tell you about Crane, Texas.
Yeah.
It's a little West Texas town, a little southeast of Odessa.
Mm-hmm.
And it had maybe the population of 3,500.
Wow.
It was very small. And most of the people that went there that were black, I was pretty much related to. So just imagine my love life growing up.
Right. Gonna make extra sure someone's not your cousin.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right. Yeah. It was a little small town. We were known for oil, because that's where all the, you know, most of the oil pumps and oil companies would go there. And so even though it's small, it was a very rich school. So we had the best teachers that would come in because we could pay them.
Right.
You know, they would come up from all over. Everybody wanted a position, you know, at Crane because they knew the money was good. And they knew that, you know, our students were very intelligent. We weren't like we were country bumpkins, you know, but, you know, we were very smart. You know, we were progressive to be as small as we were. And that enabled us to compete with a lot of bigger schools. So I played, you know, basketball, football, and track because we didn't really have too many people there. You know, everybody played everything.
Yeah.
So, but after high school, going to college, I just focused on just basketball.
Okay.
Yeah. But I still have records there in track. Yeah. I was a serious athlete.
I believe it. And so at what point did you hook up with Kirk Franklin?
Franklin is a multi-Grammy-winning gospel and Christian hip-hop musician known for groups such as Kirk Franklin and the Family, Kirk Franklin's New Nation, and Kirk Franklin and One Nation Crew, as well as solo projects. He also collaborated with Cypher Episode 155 guest Spud Seawright on the God's Property Choir.
That was when I moved, I transferred from New Mexico Highlands University to finish my degree because I just couldn't finish there. And before I transferred, I had offers to go to University of North Texas.
Which is, for people who don't know, has one of the best jazz programs
yeah.
in the country.
I was going to be in the 11 o'clock band and or split with the 1 o'clock band.
University of North Texas's Jazz Studies program has 9 large ensembles called lab bands. One of them, the prestigious 1 o'clock lab band, has 7 Grammy nominations and over 60 recordings to its name.
But when I got there, I did get accepted. Mm-hmm. They didn't have any room on campus, so I really didn't have nowhere to live. You know, I didn't have money back then, you know.
Yeah.
So Dr. Dan Hurley told me that he had a band director that he just had transferred down to UTA, and that I should go there, and that was Dr. Bill Snodgrass.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's when I like, all right, well, I just stayed in Arlington and finished there. And then while I was going to college, you know, I needed some extra pocket change.
Right.
You know, so I was really a avid jazz and hip hop, you know, throughout. But there were a lot of churches there that needed musicians, you know. So I was
That's
like,
"What I hear?
Yeah, a lot
Spud,
of churches."
Spud said the same thing. Yeah.
So I was like, "Hey, all right, I go in, you know, get a church gig and, you know, make some extra money right there where I can pay for my tuition. So I think I was playing at some church and Kirk came in and he heard me play. And that's when we got reacquainted because I knew Kirk when he was playing at one of my aunt's and uncle's church when he was like 13, 14.
Oh, wow.
And we had a little family singing group called the Harmonaires.
Oh, right, because you're like parents or grandparents something were in a doo-wop, right?
Yeah, my mom and dad, they met in a doo-wop group. So they actually met in Fort Worth. So Kirk played at one of the churches where my dad's sister, she was like the head usher, and my uncle was like the head deacon, so they hired Kirk. But we used to go back and forth, and we would sing there, you know, as kids. And he would be there, and that's kind of how we knew each other then. Mm. But fast-forwarding to, you know, college, we got reacquainted. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I had a style that wasn't just your traditional gospel style, you know, even though I played gospel, but I threw in hip-hop, jazz, you know, just R&B, and just kind of make, you know, I had this, like, you know, hodgepodge sound. I don't know, that it was interesting, you know, that kind of worked for him.
Right. And so he had, at least on one of the records I looked at, the one that's mostly live, you on keys, I think you're mostly on organ, Bobby Sparks, and then Kirk on keys on a couple of the songs as well. How on earth do you figure out who's playing what when you got three people on keyboard?
Well, what we would do is Bobby would kind of like play the beds of a lot of things. He kind of play hold it down. And because I had grew up a lot around a lot of producers, around a lot of engineers, I would be producing on the spot. So my part was I was writing and, you know, doing music and adding things on the spot as where we were playing. So that's kind of what, that was my position. You know, I was one that, you know, add synth, add string, do this, you know, on a B3. So I had like four or five keyboards around and I'm playing, you know, two or three keyboards at one time.
Wow.
So, you know, I was like the moving part type of guy.
That sounds exactly, I can see a through line between that and what you're doing today, right?
Yeah, yeah. Pretty much. You know, amazing. I guess producing has always been, you know, in me to do it. I like playing live, love playing live, but if I'm going to play live, it's almost like I'm producing on the spot.
Right. And, you know, I found some of your early work, you know, some of the stuff you played. First off, how'd you end up with Wayman Tisdale? I mean, well, most people know him as a basketball player, not as a jazz bassist. How'd that come about?
Wow. Wayman had a nephew that sung with the family.
Oh, okay.
His name was Dalen Collins. Incredible singer. He was a second tenor. Incredible. Wayman would come to some of the shows, like with Kirk, just to come and see them. And we met him through that way. Wayman is actually a native of Fort Worth. His dad was a pastor in Fort Worth. And his dad got called to move up to Tulsa. So Wayman then went to Booker T, became this huge basketball star. But at the same time, he loved music. I mean, you know, you're in the home of Tulsa, you got the Gap Band, you know, you got other, you know, powerful, you know, musicians that came out of there, a lot of good musicians. So he was inspired to play, you know, bass at an early age. But he didn't study it. He's just kind of like a great natural, you know, ear for it.
Yeah.
So his father passed when I was working at a funeral home.
Oh.
Yeah, and Gregory W. Spencer's funeral home in Fort Worth. And my job at the funeral home, I would do vital stats, sometimes help prep the bodies. and I would play for some of the services. And we would do like between 500 to 600 cases a year. So I got plenty of practice.
Right. You know?
Plenty of it.
Oh, man. So you got the church on one end and the funeral home on the other.
Yeah. And yeah. I'm doing jazz and had a little, you know, independent, what we call hip hop label called Quiet Boys. With me and my cousin. So we, you know.
Is that where the Thugged Out Pimps came from?
Yeah, all that.
I tried so hard, by the way, to find their music, and it is not anywhere. Can you describe? First off, after the interview, you've got to send me something.
I'll give it to you.
Okay.
Perception determines social status. Pressure inflating your mind to make it hard to cope with. So would it, could it, should it be like this?
My family always asking me, why do I choke? They wondering, but the real question is, how do I cope? Chronic sex stays off in the back of my throat. Cause if it don't, I'll be another suicide victim dead, left with a note. Life gets too hard to handle when you broke. You always doing bad. That's why I'm glad I found faith through my trusty pen and pad. Can't brag about the shit I had because I ain't got it now. I
may have. So who were they?
Well, they were just a couple local guys that me and my cousin, Dion Roblo, he was like, he wanted to do something in music. And he knew that we both worked at the funeral home. We were both getting tired of working and digging up, you know, putting people in the ground. And we riding in hearse and stuff, you know, sometimes smoking a little weed, you know, thinking about what we going to do, you know, for the rest of our life. We just can't be, you know, doing this. So, you know, he knew that I was, you know, very good in production. Mm-hmm. And he's like, hey, man, let's just use, his mom was my aunt Lita. Let's just go use mama's garage and let's put the keyboard in there and see what we can do. So he had one of his relatives who was a rapper as well, where he had a brother that rapped. So Thugged Out Pimps came from, you know, just some couple of little local boys that used to come to the studio all the time. We just like, hey, let me just put them together. And it's, you know, we were trying to be, I guess, the Aftermath or, you know, anything from the West Coast, we want to be that.
Right.
Anything that Dr. Dre was doing, I want to do.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
I think everyone did around that. And there's this, like, bridge in your work, or at least I heard it that way, between, like, the gospel stuff you started out in and the more contemporary R&B you did later. To my ear, at least, Tarlynn Ramsey serves as that kind of bridge, right? Because it's gospel in lyrics, but sound-wise, it sounds more like contemporary R&B, at least to me.
I've done some things I knew that I should have. Coming to my life today.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, okay, so Tarlynn Ramsey, she was introduced to us in Tulsa when I was working with Wayman, and he signed her to his label. She was a minister, but she can really sing. And during the time I got hired on to play at Wayman's church. You know, after his dad passed, they heard me. And they was like, yo, will you move to Tulsa? I was like, yeah. He said, because I want you to, you know, help produce my next album. Because he knew how we did things. So I moved up. And my mindset then wasn't really on gospel because he was such a, you know, he was doing jazz.
Right.
So, I mean, I had to split my brain into two, from Amazing Grace to, you know, doing giant steps, you know.
Yeah.
So out of that just came a more progressive sound for her, for gospel. And, I mean, to be honest, that's kind of how we've always done it, even with Kirk and God's Property. You know, we just tried to make it as progressive, you know, to the fray as we could, you know. And then we had to make sure we wouldn't be so offensive to the church.
Sure.
So there was a certain, you know, bar we had to get to without going over, right. You know, because then we don't want Kirk to get, you know, excommunicated, you know, because he was a minister, you know, so
right.
We wanted to
right.
make sure we, you know, we kept it, you know, in good respect.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, so maybe like 06, 07, around there, you meet up with Timberland.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of told the story of how that happened before through King Logan, I think his name is.
Funny. Yeah, yeah.
Who is that? You never tell in the story, you never tell who exactly that is.
Okay, King Logan was a local drummer from Dallas.
Mm-hmm.
And he was younger than I. He, I think he and Spud was kind of like in around the same, you know, class. And King Logan came along and was, you know, wanting to get more into production. And I was doing heavy producing, you know, then. And we showed him how to, you know, work the EPS or the MP. Spud showed him how to, you know, work the MP. And he became more, you know, more adapt to that. Yeah. Started getting into mixing and getting into engineering and became really, really good. So I think I had just finished touring with Kirk. And I got a call from King. And he was telling me, yo, I need you to take this phone call, you know, or I want you to talk to somebody. So I started talking, and it had to be Timberland. And they told a story how one of the other producers they had had gotten into a little trouble, and they were right in the middle of his album.
Oh, the Shock Value record.
Yeah. So he was like, you know, he had been trying to find us on tour, but I didn't know he was because he was actually looking for a choir to sing on one of the tracks, and he was looking to use Kirk. But Kirk, we were just on tour, and we just didn't have time. So they would come show to show, especially up the East Coast, just to try to talk, and it never did happen. But he saw, you know, that I was playing. He saw, you know, heard us. You know, of course, people pay attention to the band members.
Right.
And so talked to him. He said, yeah, I remember seeing you in Richmond. You know, you was playing and, you know, you track too. I was like, yeah, yeah. And so he was like, well, let me hear something you got over the phone. I was like, okay. So we had just happened to be working on something, me and King, or something I had brought.
Yeah.
And I was like, all right. So I set up and hit.
No pressure. Just play it for Timberland.
And played it. And he was like, holy crap. He's like, you need to come up here tomorrow. And they were in Vegas. That's when Justin was on tour with Sexy back.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, you need to come to Vegas. So I'm like, damn, okay, all right, I'll be on my way. And I went up there and we kind of met and he heard some more of my stuff. And the track that I played for him ended up being one of Bobby Valentino's songs called Rearview.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, the one I, you know, so that was like one of the first cuts we did.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and then from then we had a great bond. I mean, we understood each other.
How familiar with his work were you before you jumped into that?
Oh, yeah. Come on, Tim Magoo, Missy, y'all, that. Yeah, very familiar, you know.
And did you feel you kind of had to adjust your own style? Because he had, by that point, a pretty well-established sound.
No, I didn't have to adjust. I knew his sound because I listened to him. So, you know, anybody that programmed did any drums, we're going to listen to Tim, Teddy Riley, who else was big? Dre, of course.
Because,
you know, drums, we all drummers. So, we listen to, oh, man, how he put that little hop in it, you know, because Tim had crazy.
He has his own kind of swing.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's that hop I'm talking about right here, Timbo. I can't be stopped with the hop like this, family.
So it was like we would use it in gospel, you know. So it wasn't like it was something new. We knew Tim's. Yeah, we studied him.
Yeah, can you talk about that for a second? Because he has this very particular like hip hop swing that he uses that like is very him. How would you describe it?
I don't know, man. I've been working with him since 2006, and I still can't describe it. I'll be like, how do you? And it looks so simple. Like, he doesn't really do a lot. You don't see him doing a lot, but it's just his time and his rhythm. And I think it's a test of his ear from growing up being a DJ. DJ Timmy Tim.
Mm-hmm.
And when he would tour...
I talked to No Malice about that.
A homie of mine told me, he was like, yo, I got this dude. I'm telling you, I know you don't like writing to nobody's music, but this dude got the music. I was like, all right. He introduced me to him. It was DJ Timmy Tim, Timbaland. Me and Timbaland was just, you know, always making music over his crib. And, you know, and even then, like, this is high school. So, you know, those guys was talented even then.
Yeah. And he had just bags and bags full of tapes and LPs that he studied and he listened to. He liked to listen to different rhythms, especially over in, you know, like in India. He loved their rhythms over there and how they would, you know, use their timing. And I don't know. He just became well adapted to having that universal ear that, you know, you can't really, it's not something that you, so, okay, he got that from one other producer, or, you know, mm-hmm. He originated that hop.
Right.
I mean, just bottom, I mean, hands, he did.
Yeah. And, you know, some of the first stuff you did with him wasn't really hip hop. It was kind of in this like R&B rock hybrid with the Ashley Simpson stuff. What do you remember about that?
Okay, so that was really spearheaded with me, King Logan, and Chris Gobby.
Okay.
And he came in and just, you know, he put us on it because he was working with some other artists at the time. I think Nelly and all that. They would, you know, we had to split it up because it was just so much work coming in. So he put us on Ashley, and we were in L.A., and that's all I have to say about it. I mean, I'm a huge Green Day fan. I'm a huge David Bowie. I'm a huge who else was influenced me during that point? Come to me. But it was all punk.
Mm-hmm.
The Ramones.
Which is where some of the guitars on that stuff came from.
Yes. I was so into Green Day back then, and she had a weird tone. But it was rock. It was raw. Ken says she was a great singer, which, you know, a lot of singers are not. Madonna wasn't. She's not a great singer. But they have this vibe and they have this certain aura around them that just pulls people into them, whatever, no matter what they do. And she was that. She was really a rock star. And, you know, once I heard her voice, it was just simple. It was like, yo, we just got to go this way. You can't do the candy pop stuff. You know, right. your sister's doing that. You got to be the evil twin. You know?
Yeah. And one of the things about more generally about your work with Tim, there's this mix, this line you guys walk all the time of weird and accessible.
Right.
I was thinking particularly of the song you did with New Kids, right? Super weird. It's a cappella intro. And, you know, weird breakdown where it keeps changing keys and shit. It's super weird. But then there's this hook that gets stuck in your head immediately. Can you talk a bit about balancing weird and catchy within your stuff with Timbaland?
Well, you know, he's an innovator and a trendsetter, and he's always challenges himself and he challenges anybody in his group to do the same. Don't be afraid of, you know, trying to cater to the public consumers, you know, because they're going to, if you lead, they'll follow.
Mm-hmm.
If it's something good and it's catchy, they're going to come, you know, they're going to grasp to it. So he was always trying to, you know, to reinvent himself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some things become obscure is because he, you know, people started taking his style too much.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was like, oh, we want that Timbaland sound. And people would try to, you know, copy it, but they couldn't do it. So it was almost like saturating his sound. Like he was almost making it, you know, become, you know, devalued. Mm-hmm. So he's like, all right, since they want to do that, let's go a little bit more to the edge. And he wanted to really, you know, make hip hop take over into the pop world, but give it more aggression mm-hmm. and to where everybody can accept it. Like, you know, it doesn't matter what color you're going to know. It's just Timbaland. That's the brand he was trying to create mm-hmm. to, you know, this Timbaland sound that really people can't really describe what it is.
Right.
So he just challenged us to outthink the average of the producer. Mm-hmm. So that's how all those stuff started coming around.
Okay. that makes a lot of sense. And, you know, with him and by yourself, you've worked with a lot of singers
mm-hmm.
and a lot of rappers.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the big differences?
Rappers can't sing. Singers can't rap. That's a big, that's a huge difference. No, the difference is, you know, there's a lot of things that singers look to for perfection. Like their sound has to be perfect. The note has to be perfect. It has to have this certain type of emotion, you know, to get across to the public, which in all music, that's the case. You know, you have to invoke emotion, you know, because emotions transfer.
Yeah.
You know, you can hear if a sax player, if he's want to make you cry, he can make you cry. Like, you know, but the big difference is in hip hop, you don't have to be perfect in hip hop. You know, we want raw.
Mm-hmm.
We want realness. You know, you want your drums to be a little offensive sometimes.
Right.
You know, you want that edge, and you know, and the, I mean, for me, there's not a huge difference because I try to bring that raw edginess to the singers, to R&B or to pop or whatever, you know, to where, you know, a hip hop head could listen to one of my ballads and be bobbing to it like, damn, this is hard, you know, but you know, I'm almost in tears because of the message, you know, so it's, you know, creatively, it's not that much difference to me. You know, it just, I guess, depends on, you know, who we're trying to target and what we're trying to target. And we just kind of put it all in and center it, you know, right in the middle.
Yeah. And the Justin Timberlake stuff, the 2020 experience you did, looking at, you know, huge release in terms of, you know, the amount of attention it got, how big a star he was, you know, how much it sold.
Mm-hmm.
But from what I can see, it basically was four or five guys in a room the whole time, right? You, James Fauntleroy, his guitar player, him.
Elliot Ives, that's my boy.
Elliot, yeah, and Justin and, you know, and Tim. So, you know, five people or whatever. Is that an accurate?
That's pretty much it. And
yeah?
Chris.
Oh, and right, and Chris, who was engineering mixing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, little mama.
Chris Godby engineered and mixed the 2020 experience. He's also worked with Kirk Franklin, the DOC, Jennifer Hudson, Ashley Simpson, Katy Perry, Shakira, Drake, Demi Lovato, and more.
I guess I'm just curious to what those sessions were like.
I mean, you heard it. It's there.
Mm-hmm.
It's on vinyl. That's what it was. I mean, it didn't take long. But it was, I mean, sessions were long because we just kind of, once we got started, it was kind of hard to stop. But incredible power in that room. Like, if somebody came up with a concept, it was almost like everybody just kind of like melted right in. And all these ideas just start bubbling out. And instead of talking about it, we were actually just doing it.
Playing through it.
We were playing through it.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was, I mean, that's one of the best sessions I've ever been in.
I believe it. And so were you guys worried at all about the length of the songs? And, you know, stuff is 6, 7, 8 minutes.
Nah.
No?
Nah.
I mean, obviously didn't hurt the reception any.
No, we were trying to do, you know, just trying to break the mundane format of everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, music has to be an experience to people. You know, you should be able to pick up an album and listen through it all the way through and not ever hit pause. It should have you that captive. I mean, have you ever went to a movie and, you know, skipped through a scene? Like, oh, I want to see that. So let's go to this scene. No, people are captivated. They follow the script. And that's exactly what we're trying to give you, a visual, a script,
mm-hmm.
you know, but, you know, do it through just listening. And you can envision your own theme to it. Like you can actually sometimes paint your own picture when you listen to the music, because it tells a story.
Yeah.
You know.
And you know, one other thing about the JT record, you know, I was reading, I think, an interview with Chris about Mirrors.
Mm.
And at one point in that song, in the first half, even before you get to the coda, you have like 120 tracks. At points, you have, you know, 9 tracks of beatboxing and 15 tracks of vocals and guitars. So how do you arrange something when there's that many tracks? How do you keep everything straight?
Bust it in groups. Just bust it down.
Basically, this just means grouping individual instruments together and mixing them so that you can treat each of those groups as just one instrument. When 9 beatbox tracks become one beatbox group, or bus as they're referred to, 120 tracks can quickly shrink down to less than 20, which is much more manageable.
Work at a section at a time, bus, you know. I mean, of course, the strings came later. That track was, I mean, I guess people know now, but that was a track that should have went on Shock Value 2.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Like 2007, 2008, Justin was like, you know what? Yeah, that right
keep
there.
Keep that one for myself. Yeah,
thank you. And we were like, what? And, I mean, he sat on it. He went and did movies. And then when he got ready for his album, he was like, all right, here we go.
And the coda didn't exist at first, right?
No, none of that. That was all kind of like just did while we was doing the whole session. Yeah, that didn't exist. Now you're the inspiration for this precious song. And I just want to see your face light up
since you put me on. So now I say goodbye to... That's wild. And, you know, speaking of Justin, I wanted to use that to transition into Jay. Magna Carta Holy Grail, obviously, you had a huge part in, you know, you worked on a half dozen, probably more, of the songs on it. Holy Grail, the title track, right? It's a Jay-Z song, but you don't actually hear Jay-Z until maybe like 90 seconds in. One day you're here, one day you're there, one day you care, you're so unfair. Sipping from your cup till it runneth over. Holy Grail. Can you talk about that decision? Was that done just to like build drama? Like,
my boy Dream. That's my boy.
Singer The Dream is one of 9 credited writers on Holy Grail, along with Jerome, Jay-Z, Justin Timberlake, the producer No ID, and the 3 members of Nirvana, who are credited because of an interpolation of Smells Like Teen Spirit. Nobody to blame. Kurt Cobain did it to myself.
Dream had the concept, and they had been working on it, but they needed to bring it alive. And so it was kind of like that already, but Jay just added Justin to it. Like, he went in on it, you know. So the format was almost kind of like already there, and we just took it and we just, you know, embellished it, you know, rearranged a lot of the stuff. Mm-hmm. And then once it became this big thing, then Jay went in and he's like, yo, now it's my turn. I didn't, you know, it's already huge, you know. So the format was, you know, was already there, you know, when Dream wrote it, you know.
Okay.
Yeah. And so we just, you know, we was like, oh, now we know what to do with this. So we all just collectively worked on it together and just brought it to that this huge thing.
Mm. it's an amazing, amazing song. Can you talk more generally about working with Jay? Like, you know, all we know of him in the studio is the occasional video snippets you get where, you know, he listens to 5 beats, picks one, mumbles, and then 2 minutes later, there's a song. From your perspective, what is it, is it like? You're nodding that exactly what it's like.
Exactly. Jay loves to have people in the studio. You know, like, I would be mad if I had too many people sitting there talking and bantering and this and that. I'm like, man, I can't concentrate. You know, what is all this in here?
Right.
He loves that because he listens to conversations. He listens. He may be in the back chilling, he'll have a beat on, and he listens to people's conversation, and he know how to take conversation to build a story out of it. That's why when there's controversy with Jay, he loves it. Because he takes that and he uses it and boom, throw out a song on you.
Right.
He's brilliant. I don't understand who in the world else can do that but him. So, you know, he really, really pays attention to his environment around him at all times. And he can write a story about wherever he is. I think he and Nas are the best at doing that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just taking a little simple little conversation and boom, it's a song. It's like, and it'd be real stuff. None of his stuff is fabricated.
Right.
By the way, everything he raps is real. And I learned a lot from him on a business perspective from Jay.
Yeah.
There's nobody better than in business to me in the hip hop industry that crosses through other business factors. He ain't Puffy, but I think he's brilliant with that.
Yeah. And you said he has pretty particular demands of his producers and of the tracks, that they be thematic.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
Well, again, he's a storyteller. So it has to have him to, you know, feel certain emotions to be able to bring out whatever he's trying to say. You know, I mean, he pays attention to the sounds. You know, he's like, no, make it, you know, I want a little bit more dramatic in spots, you know, because I'm feeling this way. I want to address this, you know, because he'll have a subject in his head. So, he'll spit it a cappella just so you can hear what he's saying. And it inspires you to, you know, like, oh, okay, I know exactly where he wants to go. Mm-hmm. He's a great script, right, when it comes to that, like, you know.
Yeah, I was thinking about Venus versus Mars, which you worked on, which is mm-hmm. one of the more, like, literal concept songs.
Oh, my God.
Shorty played the piano. Me, I play with white keys. Shorty from the South. Oh, I think she like me. Shorty like Pac. Me, Big Papa. Screaming, hit him up. I'm screaming, who shot you? I'm on that red wine.
Can you talk about making that?
Where were we? We're at his studio.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, when we worked on that. And, you know, we just had this beat. You know, me and Tim, we had the beat with us. And when he heard it, he was like, ooh. He started rubbing his head and moving his lips. Then he went to the cast, got him a cigar, and he just sat back. And then he'll tell Guru, all right, Guru, I'm ready. And he goes in, he'll spit about 24 bars of something to smack you across your face. And he comes back out, play the beat again. He don't want to hear what he did. All right, I'm ready. He go back in there. He has the second verse. Like, man, how are you doing this crap? Like,
yeah.
You know, so it's, the I guess the beat just made him think about, you know, men and women. I don't know. I just, you know, I'm not in his head. I wished I was. Then yeah. We'd all be rich.
Oh, my God, yeah. From your perspective, was there any kind of difference other than, you know, having handed more songs between Blueprint 3 and Magna Carta Holy Grail, kind of the sessions, the way stuff worked?
I mean, the work ethic was the same, but he just, I mean, his subject matter changes as he progresses as an entrepreneur, mm-hmm. as a businessman, as a husband, you know, so he has other stories to tell than just, you know, what's going on during that time.
Right.
He really tells about his life. So his life has changed, you know, when he got married, you know, he got the baby and now you got other, you know, influences coming at him,
yeah.
You know, so it just changed. So, you know, the music changed slightly, but not much,
mm-hmm.
you know, we want to keep Magna Carta different from Blueprint 3 because we felt as a lover of New York, the East Coast music, we felt it was on a huge decline. Like I would come to New York and I'm hearing stuff from the South. And I'm like, yo, did they send me back to Dallas? Like, where am I? What's on the radio? Like, why am I hearing Waka Flocka on, you know,
yeah.
here? Like, what the hell? You know? So we was like, yo, man, you know, we loved the East. We grew up listening to the East Coast. So, I mean, we loved it so much and it can't lose its aggression. So we, you know, Tim's from Virginia. I'm from Dallas, you know, Chris from Dallas. We just wanted to make everything hard and have that little swag, but keep it still elements of the East Coast.
Mm-hmm. And that's where something like Picasso Baby came from.
Yeah.
Christie's with my Missy, live at the MoMA. Bacon, some turkey bacon, smelly aroma. Oh, what a feeling. Picasso Baby. Picasso Baby.
Yeah, all that. We wanted to make, you know, it's a couple of other songs on there.
The Fuck With Me, You Know I Got It also has that kind of vibe to it.
Luciano is what they call me, Paisano. 100 keys at the piano, place across the Verrazano.
Yeah, that's you know, that's still kind of like the South, though. You know, you know, that's almost like the dirty South, like Houston almost to me.
Yeah.
You know, Suave House, stuff like that, you know.
Yeah.
That was that.
Speaking of Picasso Baby, were those two halves of it always together, or was that kind of added on? What you remember?
Oh, you're talking about the end of it. It's just something he wanted to divide it up.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's crazy. How do you remember the first time you heard the commercial for the album that used that?
I just want a Picasso. I'm a casa. No, my castle. I'm a hasta. Hey, yeah, you want to tweak that? Bang. That ain't supposed to work. Not against these lush sounds and this live instrumentation. That's what hip-hop is. It's the emotion.
I actually was supposed to have been in that video, but I would walk down to the pier and went to the gym. So I missed the call time. So I was coming back, and I'm like, yo, what's all these trucks doing out here? He's like, man, you know they upstairs? He's like, Tato, like, man, you know they upstairs? He's like, doing this. I was like, oh. And I had on, like, Speedos and stuff.
Hiding like, from the
camera. Yeah, I'm 6'6", you know, 3-something. I'm like, nah, I'm not going in no Speedos. Right. Sorry.
So with someone like Jay or Beyonce, a vocalist of that caliber, who's actually making the decisions of, you can do another take, sing it again, that kind of stuff in a studio environment? Who's making those decisions?
Nobody. I mean, they don't really need anyone, you know, coaching them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they've done this for so long. Like, I mean, yeah, B's been doing it since she was 6.
Right.
Like, so she's past the coaching. She knows exactly what she wants to hear.
So she'll just know, oh, I got that. Now I need to do this other section. Or
well, I mean, you know, I'm pretty sure she would take some suggestion if something is a little off, like, all that notes, you know. But other than that, she, I mean, oh, my God. Like, you talking about this girl's mind is so above what an average producer would think, because she's both singer, she's a vocalist, she can write, and, you know, she knows exactly how she wants, you know, her voice to sound. So she's going to paint that for you anyway. She's going to give it to you. And it's very simple, just a little tweak here, tweak there. You know what I mean? Because she can sing all the stuff a cappella by herself. She don't need music.
I'm telling these kids.
You know, so it's very little that going in, you know, even for Jay. I mean, because like I say, he can improv his whole album if he wanted to. He can do it by himself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've never, ever, 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 not when I worked, he never wrote anything down. Now, he ain't got no iPad. He ain't got no his little iPhone with the notes.
Yeah.
Nothing.
Amazing. So with Beyonce, you know, Drunk in Love, which you know, co-produced.
Mm-hmm.
Just became this cultural phenomenon, right? Like everyone was sort of saying the lyrics as catchphrases to each other.
Last week, we was all at the Met Ball having a great time. We've been drinking watermelon.
What was that like for you to kind of sit back after the album release and watch that happen?
I guess everybody liked to get drunk. There's a lot of alcoholics out there. I mean, you know, I really don't know going in when you're doing stuff, like when you producing or when you're in the studio with the artist. I mean, to me, everything is a hit. You know, that's the mindset.
Right. Why would you put it out otherwise?
Yeah. So I try to make everything a hit. Like, you know, it's like, you know, trying to differentiate your children. Like, who's your favorite kid or, you know, whatever. I'm like, no, they're all like, you know, I can't. you know, segregate.
Yeah.
My, you know, so it's the same with the music. Like, you know, everything's a hit. So going in, we want everything to be a hit. But you don't know the expectations of it, you know, how huge of a hit it would be.
Right.
You know, everybody has like, yeah, we want it to be huge, you know, but then you have to have reality. Like, it might just go copper. You never know. But still in my mind, that song is still a hit to me, you know. So, I mean.
And so that actually matched your expectations of what you thought it deserved to.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Drunken Love made countless critics' lists, including Pitchfork's 200 Best Songs of the Decade, and for 2 years in a row, the Village Voice's influential Paz and Job list, and was Rolling Stone's number one song of 2014. It received nominations at the Billboard Music Awards, the BET Awards, and the Soul Train Awards. It won one BET Award and two Grammys. On the radio, the song topped the Billboard Hot R&B Hip Hop Airplay chart for 8 weeks, and also went to number one on the Rhythmic Songs chart. It got to number two on the Billboard Hot 100. Sales-wise, it went triple platinum in the U.S. and platinum in five other countries.
The beats on the self-titled Beyoncé record, they sound pretty cohesive. They kind of sound like they go together. Were they made with her in mind or with that project in mind?
Nah, she did it all herself.
She chose them.
She chose, like, when you walk into her studio room, it's like a laboratory. I wanted to make sure I said that right, America. It's not laboratory, it's laboratory. Like, she has sticky notes and billboards, you know, chalkboards and just going that, like, I mean, she was like a mad scientist of how she pieced that album together. We just provided the music. She pieced it together.
Is it true some of it was recorded during a hurricane?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Remember that?
That would have been Hurricane Sandy, which made landfall in New York City in the end of October in 2012.
Yeah. We were at stand next to the Junk City Studios, right? Mm-hmm. And we were at the Americano. And so we're in the Americano lounge, you know, doing what adults do. We drink beverages, adult beverages. And, you know, it was raining. And, you know, it came on that, you know, there's going to be a possible hurricane. I'm like, yeah, right. There's no hurricane ever going to come up to New York.
Right.
Then all of a sudden, right during my one drink, all the electricity went out. And we were in total darkness. And you look down the street, it's the Hudson, right?
Yeah.
Water was coming up the street. So the elevator shut down. I'm like, oh, crap. Like, now, I can swim, but that's a lot of water out there. So after that, the next day, you know, we had to record. So we had to go up, I don't know, 9 flights, 10 flights up, get all the studio, everybody, by hand, manually. All the equipment, everything, keyboards, everything, and walk up and down that doggone stair.
Because no elevator.
No elevator. And we went to another studio. I forgot. It was in Manhattan. That's where they had, you know, had electricity. But we, you know, it was pretty rough. Because coming back, you know, from, you know, the session, I still had to go back and stay at the Americano in the dark. And that's when I really fell in love with candles.
Right.
That whole thing really tested us as professionals to really, you know, push through it. And I, you know, that was one of the, it was a task, but what came out of it was, you know, very rewarding.
I read that when you make a song, you're thinking about how it's going to sound in a couple of different ways. Live, you know, blasted in an arena, maybe during a, you know, basketball game or something, and on television. Specifically, what kinds of elements help a song translate to all those contexts?
Well, because we have so many different consumers and how we listen to things sonically. So it all has to transfer and be balanced. Okay, so if, and part two of that, I'm a music director. So I would have to go get with the sound of the house guy, you know, the stage guy, to make sure that sound translated out in the arena, that it filled up the arena, but not so loud to where it covered up the vocals. So from being a MD music director on live and being a producer, I knew how things should have to sound when somebody's performing it live. And then if you do something, or if your track come on TV at an arena and you're looking at it on TV, you have to make sure that the sonics come, you know, that they transfer as well. So I'm just thinking, you know, outside of just being your typical producer in the studio, mm-hmm. you know, because I've worked in all those different aspects. So, you know, through trial and error, I know how things should sound. You know, I'd be like, well, you know, if we're going to do this live, then we need to, you know, lower the bass, or we need to, you know, make sure that the guitars or the vocals cut through, you know, and knowing the arenas and stuff that you're in, you know, some arenas, you know, don't really fit, the speakers don't really fill up the arenas. So we had to have to think about, okay, if it doesn't fill up, then we need to put back speakers. Like, we'll put speakers in the back to kind of surround. And if you ever caught a Justin Timberlake show, like the one we did when it was he and Jay, mm-hmm. and we did it at Yankee Stadium, they had speakers placed in the back because that place is so huge. So by the time it comes to the guy that, you know, way at row 138, way up high, it's late, and there's latency, and there's, you know, it doesn't transfer. You can't really what they're saying, because then it becomes just, whoa, whoa, it drowns out. Mm-hmm. So you have to think sonically how music should translate. So, I mean, when I'm in the room, I think about all of that.
And that actually leads me to something else I was thinking about, which you come out of a context of being a musician, you know, playing saxophone, keys, bass, and being in bands, mm-hmm. whereas a lot of people producing hip hop come out of a context where they have programmed everything, worked by themselves pretty much the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
How does that, advantages does that give you? How does that make you stand out?
I mean, because I know notes. And, you know, I'm not knocking, you know, any producers that don't, because, I mean, it's not really about that. It's all about, you know, how you can deliver a project, you know. But for me, you know, when you get acknowledgement in one type of genre, and then, you know, okay, for hip hop, and then you get another genre from pop or country, be like, hey, we want to use some of that. So in this genre, they may read music. They have live musicians that know music. Mm-hmm. You know, they may have, some of them may even have charts. So you get this producer here that just knows how to program, and they throw music in his face, and okay, this is what we want to build around. And you like, what is this?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the advantage it gives me. I can either read it, I can translate it, or I can just program it.
Mm-hmm.
Either way, so it gives me a little bit more longevity in the industry. If I want to switch up, okay, maybe I want to just go do some, you know, I don't know, top 40 old school oldies, you
right.
know, and I need to know how to translate that to make it sound good in today's, you know, music.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just another advantage.
Yeah, and you know, I want to take a few minutes to talk about the business side of your career. So people, I think, have a vague idea of when a hit song happens, people get money, right? Mm-hmm. With something like Drunken Love that has, I think last I checked, 10 credited writers on it, how does that work? How do the splits work? You know, you obviously don't have to break down who got what percentage of that song. I'm not trying to get you in any kind of trouble. But who handles the negotiations? Like, how would something like that work?
Well, you have the writer side. You have the artist side, and then you have the producer side.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of splits it in half, where we don't have to do so much of the nitpicking. Okay, well, I added a symbol here, or I added the word "the."
Mm-hmm.
You know, that doesn't.
Yeah.
We don't really have to deal with that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then,
because it's just the people who make the music say, okay, well, I have half.
Yeah.
As a total, and you work it from there?
Yeah, the artist and producer always, we separated. And so with that, maybe there was a lot of writers on the artist side that, you know, they had to break off. But in an album, it all seemed like it's all together. But it's not really like that. You know, and you have your producer side, which we get, you know, writer's credit as well. Writers and producers credit. So it'll be 100%, and then they split it into halves.
Right.
Her 100 half and our 100 half. And then we split whatever, you know, we go. So it doesn't, I guess it doesn't make it seem like it's so broken down for both parties.
That makes sense. And that's all negotiation between parties. There's not like a rules you go by.
No, it's not a rule, no.
Interesting. And, you know, we were talking just before here about studio budgets and how they've been cut over the years. Can you talk about that a little bit on record? Just like what you've seen in your career. I guess you probably started going to professional studios in what, like mid-90s, something like that?
Man, I've been going to studios since 8th grade.
Okay, so before then.
Yeah, there's a guy that, out of West Texas who went to Cal Berkeley, and he moved to Odessa, and he worked at the only music store that was downtown. And I was just one of those cats, you know, that would go at 13, 14, hang out because, you know, they may have a new DX7, you know, the Moog. And he was a studio musician. And he saw my talent. You know, he knew who I was. And anytime I needed to go and learn, I would just go up to Paul. And Paul taught me how to, you know, all about wave shaping, sound shaping, programming. You know, this is before we even had drum machines. You know, I mean, we had the SP-1200. Yeah, maybe, you know, but he taught me how to do that stuff on keyboards.
Wow.
When they started really being, you know, when they started putting it all in one. And so that experience kind of, you know, took me to the level where I am now, you know, where it translate, you know, from doing mainstream or doing pop or doing R&B. You know, the basic programming he showed me.
And but you've seen over the years, like the amount of time you have to spend in a studio on a given project slashed.
Exactly. See, well, what's going on now is because of the advent of programming machines, and you have Ableton, you have GarageBand, they've made it to where it's simple enough that your local little kid could do it and doesn't even have to touch anything that has any music on it. It's pretty much drawing it in. So a lot of hits came out of that.
Yeah.
So the studio was like, hey, man, this little kid over in Canada just sent me a million tracks. And, you know, he'll come in with a little laptop, a mouse, and that's it.
Right.
So how much does that cost? Nothing.
Right.
I mean, you know, this cats out here, they would tell you, they would pay you to take their beat. Yeah, there's a lot of them out there. They're like, here, man, take my beat. Here, it's $500. Panda, that track cost him maybe $250. I get broads in Atlanta.
The English producer Menace sold Designer the beat for his hit song Panda for $200 back in 2014.
And look how much it is now. I mean, I'm pretty sure he did it in GarageBand, you know? So you got your execs like, man, why are we paying these cats to sit in here for 50 and 60 hours on a day, spending up, you know, 25 to 40 grand a day, when we can get this laptop kid coming here with already beats ready and people write to it, just have writing camps, let them write to the beats. That only takes about 2 or 3 days at max.
Yeah.
So they're like, well, that just saved us 250 grand. So budgets start getting slashed with producers. They're like, no, we're not giving you up front. You got to see what you do, because if you don't got none, we got this little guy right here, 17 years old, with a bunch of beats.
Oh, wow. So you don't get paid until something's chosen?
Until something's chosen.
Wow.
Yeah. So, you know, at least it's either you work with the top artists, or you have to deal with the, you know, the artists that are just coming out that don't have much budget. And you got to play that game with them. Like, all right, well, here's a bunch of tracks. See what you like. You know, maybe I can get the back end, you know, something, you know. So the game has changed to that because, I mean, production has became simple. Mm-hmm. It's very simple.
How do you think about sampling? Like, obviously with albums with the budget of like a Beyonce or a Jay-Z, you can in theory afford to clear any sample or almost any sample you might want to use. Like, how do you, as a producer, how do you think about sampling?
Me personally, I think sampling is, it's a statement that has been embedded in hip hop since we started. I mean, since they, you know, it wasn't sampling, it was just catching a beat off a record, you know, and just loop it, you know. I mean, but it was still kind of like sampling. Some hip hop artists, they have to have it because it means hip hop. That's where it started. You know, when bands going out there playing until you got to what, the Tetris 3 or somebody did that, started, you know, some bands started playing the music or, you know, because they couldn't afford to pay the sampling. Like, mm-hmm. They couldn't get it clear. But other than that, I mean, it's hip hop. Without it, I mean, you know, you may not, you know, people are like, oh, that ain't real. You know, a bunch of musicians playing on it. But now it's going back to people being more creative because when you sampling costs money, especially when it's not cleared.
Right.
You know, it can
definitely talk to some producers about that.
It can definitely come back and bite you in the butt.
Right.
Hard.
Right.
But I don't knock it. I don't do it because I feel like I'm creative enough to just come off, you know, top of my head and come up with something. I know about writing. Mm-hmm. I know about scoring, you know, so I just take that and do it the programming, you know, just come up with it, you know, off top, unless I can get something cleared without any issues.
Yeah. You know, I was curious on the business side, I don't even know if you know, something like on Holy Grail, there's a very small Nirvana interpolation.
Mm-hmm.
How much would something like that end up costing? Like, how difficult was it to get that particular one cleared? Did you have anything to do with that?
I didn't have anything to do with that. That was as Jay,
mm-hmm.
you know, as something that he just came, you know, that was just off inside of his rap.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm pretty sure it wasn't hard for him to get it cleared.
Right.
You know, he's a megastar. Right. You know, so
fair enough. And we were talking before, you're trying even more than being, you know, producer, musician, you know, all in one. You try to be all in one to touring musicians as a whole with some of your business moves. Can you talk about that?
Okay, so like I prefaced my comments about how I was inspired business-wise, just hanging around, you know, Jay. You know, that just came, it just all came about when we worked on, you know, on Magna Carta. Just looking at him and watching him and just seeing his day-to-day,
mm-hmm.
How he really maximized his money, mm-hmm. and how he really makes it work. You know, to him, music, he could do it without getting paid because it's such a passion. It's a passion for me. I mean, I don't really have to get paid to do music because I love it. I do it all day, every day. I mean, I walk around humming and beatboxing all day, and nobody came up with a publishing check, you know, just because I'm walking around, you know, because it's a passion to me, you know. So you take that passion and you figure out how to make money with it. That's what my dad told me. He said, son, whatever you love, whatever your passion, do it. Even if you have to do it for free and then figure out how you can capitalize off of it later. So that becomes fuel money for another vision. So that's just a machine. This, what we're doing is just a machine for something else greater in life. And I watch him and I see all the moves and power moves he make, and he did it all by starting rapping.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so who wouldn't be inspired by that? You know, who wouldn't want to take that and, you know, maximize what you get? Because, you know, it's a fickle business.
Mm-hmm.
They can love you right now and hate you the next 10 minutes. All right, we don't like them no more.
Right. And you're trying to get more involved in the touring side.
Touring, promotions. I'm doing trucking, freight. I'm getting more into that. You know, I'm just because I mean, I sat back and I'm like, what can America not do without? And there was, a, you know, about four or five top things they can't do without. Mm-hmm. You know, can't do without transportation. Can't do without anything medical, hospitals. Can't do without real estate. Can't do without food. So I was like, okay, so what is something that I know that I can adapt to? And I come from a family of truck drivers, truckers, working in the oil field. And I swear I wouldn't do it. That's why I wanted to go to college and be a huge basketball star, because I wasn't working in the oil field.
Right.
But that experience growing up, I knew how important transportation was. So I said, oh, let me just go on a freight. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's what I want to do. I want to take, you know, what I've earned and what I've worked for and, you know, what my passion brought me and just kind of, you know, moving around.
Excellent. And one or two final things here. There have been rumors for years of a Nas song with Jay and Justin and Tim called Sinatra in the Sands.
The existence of this still unheard song was first acknowledged by Timbaland and then Nas in 2013. Nas said of the song's lyrics, Sinatra has been around and he has a long, long standing with the stage and the audience for years. And he evolved. His talent got better just like wine. And I think that's something a lot of people want to achieve. So that's what this song is really about. Striving to be the best you, like Sinatra had become.
Yeah, I remember that.
When will we get to hear it?
You guys, Jay, I'm sorry. I have no control over that. I wish he'd drive it tomorrow, you know, but I don't know.
Yeah.
That's a dope track. Like, how did you know about that?
Someone involved, I don't remember who, had mentioned its existence in interviews a couple of years ago, back when it looked like it might actually be coming out on a Nas project or something.
To me, that's a great track, but I can see it being licensed in a movie or something. Mm-hmm. Somebody should dig a little deeper in that and think of a mobster movie in Vegas.
Yeah. So what else is going on? What else are you in the middle of right now?
I'm in the middle of, like I said, I'm establishing my freight company, mm-hmm. keeping that going. And I've been working on some Ashanti material.
Wow.
Yeah.
Excellent.
And I'm here to tell you, it sounds really, really good. It came to me through a friend of mine and that worked at Sony Epic, Jeff Juin. Mm-hmm. And I guess she was getting ready to work on some more material mm-hmm. after Braveheart. And I was in the studio in L.A. working with a musician writer friend of mine. Her name is Troy. I think she just got signed to Def Jam. And she embodies everything punk and rock. She's actually from Vegas. So we were working on really a progressive punk, rock, soul, you know, type of stuff then. And when they came to us, I mean, head-wise, I was somewhere totally different in R&B. I was like, I didn't want to hear no R or B,
yeah.
You know. Didn't want to be involved with it, you know.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you know, I like to create. Like I said about Tim and myself, we try to push envelopes. You know, we don't just want to be, you know, the next Mike Will. You know, Mike Will is Mike Will, and we love Mike Will. I want Mike Will to always be known for his sound. Mm-hmm. And I always try to copycat a lot of these cats around here, you know. So when she came to me, I was very reluctant. I was like, I don't know. You know, I'm thinking about punk rock soul, like, you know. My headspace is somewhere different, but you know, after talking to him, I said, okay, I'll try it. You know, so Troy and I actually started working together on some of her stuff, and all of a sudden it just became this thing. It's like, okay, well, that track sounded pretty good. Let's try another one. And it just kept going and kept going. And all of a sudden we have 11 tracks.
Wow. One of the oddest projects you've been involved in with Scream was Chris Cornell's solo record, which caught a lot of people off guard, to put it mildly.
Scream was was a 2009 solo album by Chris Cornell, singer of the grunge band Soundgarden. The album was executive produced by Timbaland, and Harmon played a huge role, earning writing credit on every song. The record sold well initially, but had a huge second-week drop, and was critically panned, and even called embarrassing by Trent Reznor of Nine Inch Nails.
Can you talk about that record?
Well, of course, Chris Cornell, rock god voice of the ages. I mean, Soundgarden, I mean, you know, what more can I say? Like, I grew up on that grunge, you know, Nirvana type of sound. And Chris was one to break away a little bit from doing a progressive, you know, grunge rock, you know, because growing up, he listened to a lot of crooners, a lot of Sam Cooke. You know, a lot of Otis Redding. I mean, if you listen, he's very bluesy, which most singers that grew up in there, that's what they listen to. I mean, you know, rock is nothing but blues sped up.
Yeah.
It's blues. You know, it's the blues. So a lot of them cats listen, they love the blues, and they love old school, you know. But he came to Tim because he was a huge fan, and he wanted to kind of do, you know, break away and just do some more, you know, R&B, bluesy, you know, type of songs, but keeping it more, you know, progressive. And, you know, when he came, I was surprised. I didn't believe it, number one. I was like, no way. Like, what the hell are we going to do for him? Like, you know, this can't be possible. But when he, you know, discussed how he, you know, felt, you know, we went forward with it. To me, it was one of the best projects I ever worked on, actually. Because if you listen to it, it was the beginning of what 2020 is now, where there was no breaks, no stops, everything just kind of flowed in and went to each other. But his fans just wasn't ready to accept that. I mean, there was songs off of that did work, and that he even put on some other, you know, projects.
Right, he put on his live record.
Yeah. It did work, you know, and we did get some licenses from it, you know, so it did work, you know, it did, but... You know, it just, the public, you know, a lot of R&B and hip-hop people didn't really know too much about Chris Cornell until you tell them Black Hole Sun. Oh, I love that song. You know, that's the only thing they would know, but they didn't, you know, I mean, I'm a crate digger. You know, I listen to that stuff, so I appreciated, you know, the challenge that was before us, that, you know, putting it together. But had it been Justin, it exploded.
Mm-hmm. So you can see another universe in which someone else without his baggage sang those songs.
Oh, yeah.
And it was huge.
I can see it coming back 5 years from now and it blows up. You know, mm-hmm. There's been a lot of projects like that that maybe didn't work in that era. But then you have some kid who was like 7 years old then and now they're 21. They go, oh, fuck. Did you hear this? When did this come out? And it becomes... you know, reintroducing to the public again. Mm-hmm. And I think that project was a little ahead of its time.
And one final thing, most important of all, what is Cher really like?
I don't know. America, I never met her. We talked to her on the phone and she sounded very sexy. That's all I know. And I thought we would be able to meet her and I was kind of let down. You know, because I used to watch Sonny and Cher growing up in our little living room when I had my little drum set, you know, and then Captain Tania would come on after that, and I had my little keyboard set up.
Oh, well, I'm sorry. I'm sorry you got let down because you did. Yeah. You did a song with her.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah.
Yeah, me and Bonnie McKee, and I forgot the other writer. But you heard of Bonnie McKee?
Yeah. She's written everything, yeah.
Yeah.
Singer and songwriter Bonnie McKee is best known for her work with her close friend Katy Perry and has co-written many of Perry's hits, including California Girls and Teenage Dream. She also co-wrote Teo Cruz's Dynamite and songs for Britney Spears, Adam Lambert, Rita Ora, and many more.
And I forgot the other writer, but the other writer, she wrote a lot for Beyonce as well. I can give it to you later, but we all worked together on that. Mm-hmm. I mean, we actually had some dope stuff. I'm glad you brought that up. I may have some tracks I can pull out. You can hear it. Like,
all right.
Yeah, but yeah, never met her. I'm still looking forward to meeting her because, man, that voice was turning me on the phone.
All right. Well, Cher, if you're listening, you know where to go.
Yes.
All right. Thank you, Jerome Harmon. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Talking to Jerome reminded me more than anything of the importance of versatility. Just by going through his catalog, you quickly come to understand that he was ready for any kind of musical challenge thrown his way, from gospel to rock to jazz to R&B to hip-hop to whatever that Chris Cornell album was. Harmon also provides crucial insight into what really goes on in making a hit song. Listening to, say, Drunk in Love or Holy Grail is one thing, but understanding what goes into making tracks that will last for years to come is a whole other thing entirely. Like I said at the beginning, make sure that you never miss an episode by subscribing to The Cypher on your podcast app of choice. If that app is iTunes, it's hugely important to give us a rating and a review. And don't forget to visit patreon.com/thecyphershow if you enjoy the program and help us out with as little as a dollar a month. If you want to talk to me or Josh about the show, visit us on social media. We're at The Cypher Show on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and Tumblr. Let us know what you thought of the episode and who you'd like to see in the future. More information about anything related to the podcast, playlists, our complete archives, and more can be found at thecyphershow.com. Join us next week when our guest will be Sophia Chang. Sophia is a longtime music business power player who has guided the careers of RZA, GZA, Old Dirty Bastard, Q-Tip, Rafael Sadiq, D'Angelo, Organized Noize, and many more. We'll discuss her life, career, and what it was like to be, as the title of her new blog has it, raised by Wu-Tang. You won't want to miss it. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sotero.
Putting people in the ground and we riding in hearse and stuff, you know, sometimes smoking a little weed.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
He doesn't really do a lot. You don't see him doing a lot.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
He's want to make you cry. He can make you cry.
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
Right. Anything that Dr. Dre was doing, I want to do.
Special thanks to Patreon supporter Quincy Davis.
Hey, why am I hearing Waka Flocka?
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
But I like to hear what I said.